My name is Andrew Feinstein. I'm a former ANC Member of Parliament from South Africa. I'm an investigative author. I write about the global arms trade, and I'm also an anti-racist campaigner based on my experience fighting apartheid in South Africa and as the son of a Holocaust survivor from Austria.
One of the most extraordinary statements made during this latest Gaza conflict has been from the Labour leader, Keir Starmer. He's a human rights lawyer, and he said at the very beginning of this attack by the Israelis that actually it was okay for the Israelis to cut off food, cut off water, cut off electricity, stop fuel supplies getting into these over 2 million people. And yet he said it was also at the same time very important that the Israeli government did not break any of the tenets of international humanitarian law, so human rights law, so to stay within the law. So what do you make of that statement? It seems to be quite contradictory.
Well, you know, as with so much that Keir Starmer says, it's nonsense. I mean, all he's doing is trying not to take a position on anything. And at the moment, when we have what is in effect a genocide being committed against the Palestinian people by Israel, to have a human rights lawyer, the leader of what is supposed to be a democratic socialist country, and someone who happens to be my own constituency MP, talking this nonsense is just embarrassing. And why do I say that? Well, first of all, because to say that it was fine for Israel to do those things meant that it's fine for Israel to violate international law, to commit war crimes. So what the second statement was supposed to mean, one doesn't quite know. He's basically trying to square a circle. And the circle is that he wants to do whatever he can to placate various right-wing Jewish communal organizations like the Jewish Board of Deputies, media like the Jewish Chronicle, because of what they did to Jeremy Corbyn and because of what was a witch hunt against people, anti-racists, accused of anti-Semitism. The irony of that being that the people who were accusing them tended to be extremely right-wing and often racist themselves, accusing anti-racists effectively of racism. And while at the same time, you know, Starmer, who's only interested in one thing, and that's winning power for himself personally, not because he has any principles or values that he would like to see implemented, tried with that sort of very weak final statement to not alienate Muslim voters or any voters who might be pro-Palestine, pro-human rights, pro the rule of international law. And he got it completely wrong because by what he said in the first instance, it didn't matter what else he said. He was making his position 100% clear. And nothing he's done since has suggested anything else. I mean, he still hasn't called for a ceasefire. So, you know, the leader of the Labour Party, my own MP, is basically a human rights lawyer who seems to have no humanity and seems to know nothing about rights.
Well, what do you make of the conflict? There's been all sorts of interesting, well, I would say maybe even suppressed in the mainstream media, news come out suggesting that the Egyptians actually did warn the Israelis 3 days before the attacks by Hamas that they were about to come. I mean, this is a very secure border normally, but not that morning. And also these accusations of the war crimes with the bombing of the hospital, the Israelis immediately came out and said, actually, it wasn't us. This was Hamas that killed 500 people in a hospital. So what do you make of some of the minutiae of what's really been going on here? Because it seems it's been a bit of a superficial, there's been quite a superficial coverage of this in the mainstream press. The BBC have actually had people in Gaza, but many of the mainstream media in Britain, so for example, the Murdoch Empire, don't seem to have anybody actually in Gaza at all. So can you just explain what you think's been going on over the last couple of weeks?
Well, I think the superficiality of the mainstream media on this issue is hardly a surprise. They have to be facile and superficial because their bosses, the people who effectively control the media in our country and in most of the so-called Western world, have particular political agendas. And these are right-wing agendas at best. And it's driven by who controls the media. And the media is controlled by very similar people who control the economies in our country generally. And, you know, I believe in all of our countries, we have what the American journalist Greg Palast described as the best democracy money can buy, because our democracies are bought and so is our media. So the media, the mainstream media, is slavishly pro-Israel. And in order to be able to maintain even an iota of dignity or credibility with that sort of position, of course your coverage has to be completely facile, because if you did detailed on the ground reporting on the situation, you couldn't maintain the appalling positions they generally reflect. And those positions are: one, either this attack was one of the most profound intelligence and military failures in Israel's history, which I think probably was the case, and or you have to argue that, you know, it was an extraordinary operation by Hamas, which that same media regards as some sort of extreme militant ragtag sort of military. So both sides of that narrative can't really hold up to any scrutiny. And then when, you know, you come to the bombing of the hospital, the evidence is so overwhelming that you had Israel warning Palestinians in Gaza that this attack was going to come. You had them warning the churches with whom the hospital is very closely affiliated for days before the attack that this attack was coming. Then you have someone supposedly linked to Prime Minister Netanyahu's media operation. Immediately the bombing took place, congratulating the IDF on this incredibly successful operation before that had to be retracted and all of the sort of denials started. And the denials are as facile as the media coverage has been. Israel have to deny the bombing of that hospital. It is so blatant and egregious a war crime that to actually admit to committing that crime would see even Israel probably turn up in the International Criminal Court accused of crimes against humanity. So they have to deny it. But if you look at those people who have actually done quite deep and meaningful investigations of it, and here I'm talking about Al Jazeera on the one hand and an outfit called Forensic Architecture on the other, who've really pieced together quite compelling evidence that first of all shows that the rockets that the Israelis claimed actually came from within Gaza that hit the hospital, that all four of those rockets were destroyed by Israel's missile defense shield. And Forensic Architecture then puts together an incredibly compelling piece of research that shows that to an incredibly high degree, it is extraordinarily likely that the only place that ordnance could have come from was from Israel. So rather than dealing again with the corrupted Western media's attempts to act as apologists for Israel, a position that, interestingly, the New York Times seems to have rowed back on a bit in relation to the hospital attack, what we're getting are these incredibly superficial defenses of Israel. What they should be doing is attacking Israel for the egregious nature of its assaults. But the thing that perhaps disgusts me most of all, given my own personal history, which is linked to both sides in this conflict. You know, my mother lost dozens of her family in places like Auschwitz. And we obviously have relatives and friends both in Israel and in Palestine. And what really astonishes me is how few people of our political leaders, of our media class, are able to say every human life is sacred and is of equal value. And we should be mourning all lives that have been lost in this tragic episode that has unfolded in the last few weeks.
Andrew, one of the other things which we have seen virtually nothing of in the UK is the protests going on in Tel Aviv. Now, there has been a bit of coverage. These protests have been against Netanyahu directly, calling him crime minister. There are three counts of fraud against him going through the courts still. I mean, it's been years now. These cases have been chugging on, and now he's successfully changed the law in order to try and, well, the constitution, in fact, in order to stop the Supreme Court prosecuting him effectively. So there's been these big protests going on. You know, these are Jewish Zionist protests going on in Tel Aviv. Plus, since the beginning of this Gaza outrage, there's been also many protests going on in Tel Aviv outside the defense ministry, particularly of family members of those who were taken hostage, who are disagreeing very vehemently with this bombing campaign. We think between 20 and 30 of those hostages have probably been killed by the Israeli bombs. So what do you make of this interesting development in civil society, where you've actually got tens of thousands of Zionists challenging Netanyahu and saying, actually, you're destroying our dream of a Jewish homeland in Israel. And the people they're directing this against is this new political far-right Greater Israel political bloc.
Yeah. So what I would recommend is that anybody who's really interested in this stuff, because it is fairly nuanced and complex, I've done a series of Double Down News that are available online that people should listen to, because this Israeli government is, you know, avowedly and proudly fascist in nature. It is deeply racist. It is deeply undemocratic. And you're exactly right where you started off, that the main reason for the judicial reforms in Israel are because Netanyahu himself personally is facing all sorts of criminal investigations. And in addition to the three counts of fraud, you know, there are numerous counts of other far more major corruption, including involving a number of vast arms deals, where in one case, for instance, Netanyahu's own official legal advisor, who also happens to be his cousin, was actually used as the agent by the defense company that was paying the bribes to politicians, military officials, and others in Israel. So, you know, these judicial reforms are like Berlusconi in Italy, like Trump in the United States of America, like Orban in Hungary, et cetera, are, again, these sort of ethno-nationalist leaders who are trying to undermine the basic rule of law in their own countries in order to protect themselves from prosecution. And Netanyahu's doing exactly the same. The one thing I think we should say is, you know, Israel has never been, although some people would claim this, a shining light of democracy. It has been a democracy only for a tiny segment of the population. It has never been a democracy for Palestinian Israelis. And of course, it hasn't been anything like a democracy for Palestinians who live under a brutal and illegal occupation. And we need to understand that this is a criminal fascist government in power in Israel at the moment. You know, we have a minister of security who is responsible for policing the occupied Palestinian territories, who, I mean, has actually been accused of terrorism. He's actually been convicted of certain hate crimes within Israel itself. Some people partly blame him for the assassination of the late Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, for certain things that he said in the lead up to the assassination. This is a man who lives on an illegal settlement in occupied Hebron, who has a picture of a chap called Baruch Goldstein in his house. And Baruch Goldstein was this Jewish supremacist who shot dead more than 20 innocent Palestinians and who someone like Ben-Gavir absolutely venerates. So, you know, we must be absolutely clear about the nature of this government. And what is so interesting is that there are people in civil society, there are ordinary people in Israel who are turning against this fascist government. And they're doing it for different reasons. You know, some of them are doing it because they believe that Netanyahu has shown himself incapable of defending Israeli lives. Others are doing it because they think the extreme nature of what is clearly just vengeful revenge that is being perpetrated against all Palestinians in a form of collective punishment that is a war crime. There are some Israelis who find this reprehensible and repulsive. And it's why, again, you know, the sort of notions that are projected in our media of Israel as one unified society, or as Jews who are all of one mind about all of these things, is such absolute nonsense. There are complexities and nuances to the situation that we have to understand. But then, while there are complexities, there are also things about it that are incredibly simple. And that is that the Palestinian people, since the Nakba, have been under the most appalling and brutal occupation known in history. And I grew up in apartheid South Africa, so I know about this sort of racist oppression. And that the sort of reaction from Israel to Hamas's action, and I greatly deplore the loss of innocent lives in the Hamas action, but I can also understand how, like in apartheid South Africa, brutal violence by the state beget awful violence by those seeking liberation and freedom. But that the nature of the Israeli response is completely out of order, and that our political leaders, that our media cannot outrightly condemn what is going on in Palestine, what Israel is perpetrating, is perhaps the greatest failure of courage and conscience that I have seen since the heyday of apartheid South Africa.
Well, look, a lot of people are framing this as a Islamic Jewish conflict, a religious conflict. Would you agree?
That's an absolute nonsense. You know, that is the sort of, it's the sort of Manichean worldview of everything can be defined as either good or evil. There is no nuance, there is no complexity. And, you know, just as we have been speaking about the fact that there are Israeli Jews who are either non-Zionists or anti-Zionists who deplore what the Israeli government is doing, there are people on the right wing who are angry with the Israeli government about their reaction. Similarly, you know, to talk about Muslims as though they are all of one mind, as though they are all of one thought, is deeply reductionist and, frankly, deeply racist. And as a Jew, I find it deeply racist. You know, the fact that when I express the views that I have, that I was taught by my anti-racist ancestors who experienced the very worst of racism during the Holocaust, when, you know, that's the inspiration for my anti-racism. And some people say to me, oh my God, well, then you can't be a proper Jew. I mean, who are these people to decide what is or isn't a proper Jew? I mean, that shows such a lack of understanding of religion, of culture, of everything else. And it's equally the case with Muslims. You know, who is to decide who is a Muslim and who is not? Who represents Muslims, who does not? And also, it's very important to realize that not even all Palestinians are Muslims, for goodness sake. There are many Christian Palestinians and Palestinians of no faith. And these are all complex communities, and to try and reduce it to this sort of clash of civilizations, as one particular theory had it, is just a way for incredibly stupid, often racist people to try and understand what are quite nuanced issues. And the reality is we shouldn't lose sight in these issues of the fact is you can be on the side of human rights and international rule of law for everybody. And that includes Israel, it includes Russia, it includes Ukraine, it includes the Palestinians, or you can think that only certain people should have to stick to the international rule of law when it suits us in the West. And then we have to accept that there is no international rule of law and the world is chaos and anarchy. You can't have it both ways. So I think all of these debates, when you try and reduce them to this sort of black, white, good, bad, become an absolute nonsense. And unfortunately, that's what our politicians and our media try and do to us. Because if we actually applied our minds to what is going on in the world, in our names, often using our tax pounds, because some of the weapons that are being used to kill Palestinians at the moment are very, very, very heavily subsidized by our tax pounds through British defense companies like BAE Systems and others. And, you know, they want us to not think about these issues, to accept the nonsense that they sprout and that their apologists in the media write about and broadcast about, so that we don't think about these issues. Because anybody who has an iota of humanity will look at what is going on in Palestine at the moment and say, this has to stop, and it has to stop now. And I'm really glad to see that if you look at opinion polls, the vast majority of British people actually think that way. So I believe that our politicians and our media are completely out of touch with what ordinary Britons think. And that's why we need to use alternative media to actually get the real news and to get the sort of nuanced position of what is going on in the world, particularly at the moment in Israel and Palestine.
Yeah, I think maybe a child of six even could see a ceasefire is absolutely 100% necessary. It's only a university educated politician or maybe a journalist that doesn't sees things otherwise. But look, at the end of the day, we're in a very dangerous situation right now. We've got the Israeli army poised on the edge of Gaza. We've got food, water, electricity, etc. Fuel being stopped from getting into Gaza by Israeli threats against the Rafah crossing. We've also got the NATO warships chugging to the eastern Mediterranean, some of them now already in position. We've also got Hezbollah poised on the border. We've got the Syrians also potentially poised on the border, threatening to go into Israel if they go into Gaza. So very dangerous knife edge of a situation. Well, where do you think this might be going, Andrew, and what should we be watching out for?
Well, it's very interesting because, you know, if we think back a few months, we were equally concerned, and rightfully so, about the situation between Russia and Ukraine and the fact that nuclear weapons could become a part of the conflict, which of course has existential consequences for humanity. And, you know, we have a lot of political leaders in the world today who goodness knows how they ever got into these positions, because they have shown very little integrity, very little intellect, and very little common sense. And that applies across much of the world. I mean, the political class of today is just an appalling reflection of how completely corrupted our politics have become. And if you think about the next American election as likely to be another context between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, you know, one has to say to oneself, is this actually the best that the United States can offer the world at this point? Because it's a huge indictment of the state of our politics. And I think you're quite right that, you know, this could go one of a number of ways. And I think what we have to watch out for is we have to watch out for whether Netanyahu feels that his only hope for political survival is to continue to murder innocent Palestinians, and whether our political leaders in our countries are going to actually support him in doing that, both by the sale of arms and by the diplomatic cover they provide to him. And if that is the case, we have to fill the streets across our countries, in this case, particularly the United Kingdom, and we have to bring our government to a standstill, because our government will then be complicit in war crimes and genocide, and we simply cannot allow that. The other possibility, of course, is that the Middle East, and the greatest problem of the Middle East, as so many people have said over the years, has been Western interference in the Middle East that has gone on for decades and decades and decades and decades. And the sort of proxy wars that get fought in the Middle East that we are actually ultimately behind. And I think we have to be very clear to if we see our own governments continuing to enable and facilitate what Netanyahu and his fascist government in Israel are doing, then we have to try and stop that. Similarly, if we are going to see Hezbollah involvement in the conflict, you know, we're then talking about potential Syrian involvement in the conflict. Are we talking about potential Iranian, Saudi, Emirati, Qatari involvement in the conflict? And the Middle East, in a worst case scenario, could quite literally become the fire that leads to what is another global war. Instead, what we have to be focused on is demanding an immediate ceasefire now, is demanding an immediate halt to any arms sales to Israel right now. And I think the only way that we as ordinary people sitting in the United Kingdom can deal with this in any sort of meaningful way is to say to our government, you are not doing what we want you to do, and you are supposed to represent us. I think that's the best way that we can try and understand this conflict and stop it developing into something even more widespread and even worse, in which we see many, many more tens of thousands of innocent lives lost.
Finally, Andrew, many people will look at this and say, well, nobody really wants a war. This is just kind of, they've just slipped into this. But of course, there are people around the world, and you've written about this, that make a lot of money out of war, aren't there?
Well, absolutely. So there are two things I'd say in response to that. You know, people who don't really want a war, there's been a war going on between Palestine and Israel since the Nakba, since 1948. And the fact that we can't even understand the current events in the context of that ongoing war, again, just shows a paucity of understanding of the region and of the realities of Israel and Palestine. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is that, you know, my work for the last 20-something years primarily reflected in a book called The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade and a film of the same title, shows that one of the greatest drivers of conflict and war in the world in which we live is the economic benefits that accrue to the big arms companies in the world, the Lockheed Martins, the BAE Systems, the Raytheons, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we've seen since the 7th of October, we've seen the share prices of those companies absolutely skyrocket. And the reason that that is of even further relevance to us is the people who make money out of those companies making money aren't just the company executives and the shareholders, but it's also all of our politicians. Because when these massive arms deals happen with countries like Israel, with even between, you know, our country and Saudi Arabia, between ourselves and the United States of America, there are bribes in these deals. The trade in weapons accounts for 40% of all corruption in all global trade. And some of those bribes find their way back into the hands of the politicians, the military and intelligence leaders, and the political parties in both the buying and selling countries. So effectively, the billions that are made and recycled through these bribes, through the global arms trade, which of course requires conflict to keep our defense budgets at these ridiculously high levels, that money is effectively oiling our political systems and ensuring that our politicians, even when they serve for a matter of days rather than anything else, are never again going to want for anything materially again in their lives. Because this corrupted global national security elite is effectively providing the money that oils the wheels of our political systems. And that is why we have these corrupted, appallingly incompetent governments and systems of governments in most of our countries today. So we have to have conflict, and conflict is incredibly good for these companies and all of those who support them, primarily our politicians and our military structures.
Fascinating. Anyway, Andrew, you mentioned a book there. Could you tell us what it's called and how listeners can get hold of it if they want, and also how they can follow you maybe on social media or sure. blogging or whatever?
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of the main book to read about this that I've written is called The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, published by Penguin. It's in about a It's 10th or 11th edition now, and it's available. I mean, you can buy it online. You can buy it in some bookshops or order it in some bookshops still. You can also look online for the film that is simply called Shadow World. Or you can find links to all of these things on my social media, primarily Twitter, where my handle is just my name, Andrew Feinstein, or on Facebook, Instagram, etc.
Okay, Andrew Feinstein, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.